I find it hard to believe the events of the past 24 hours, or the plea of Mr. Spock standing general court-martial.
How do you plead to the charge of unlawfully taking command of this starship? Yodi. Of sabotaging the computers of this vessel and locking it on a course for planet Talos IV. Yodi. And of forcibly attempting to transport Captain Pike to that planet. Yodi.
Why? Why does Spock want to take to that forbidden world, his former captain, mutilated by a recent space disaster? Now a shell of a man, unable to speak or move. The only answer Spock would give was on the hearing room screen. How Spock could do this, he refused to explain. But there before our eyes, actual images from 13 years ago of Captain Pike as he was when he commanded this vessel, of Spock in those days, and of how the Enterprise had become the first and only starship to visit Talos IV.
Now, Whom Pods Destroy.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I'm the host, Terry DeFallon, and I'm joined by the other host, Derek Mantle.
Hello!
And another host, Graham Sibley.
Hello!
This episode of Whom Pods Destroy is going to be all about The Menagerie, Part 1 and Part 2, but we will try and keep it within a nice, comfortable half an hour framework for you so as not to overburden you, dear listener, because we know we are not the only Star Trek podcast out there. Gents, this episode is an absolute triumph, in my opinion, and in many ways a vitally important episode of Star Trek. One, obviously the narrative, the stories, the worlds it's building. We're going to talk about Pike and Discovery in a minute, but also the fact that it came at a time when they were so far behind on their optical effects for other episodes in the first season of Star Trek that they were very close to actually missing their air date. They could have actually not been able to put a show out on the air in its time slot because they just simply hadn't finished an episode. They had not one completed episode. So they used the cage, wrote an envelope story around it, and turned it out with only 4 weeks of post-production. And the average is between 12 and 14 weeks of post-production.
Wow.
For Star Trek, for an original series episode of Star Trek. The average all around was about 8 weeks. The average for Star Trek was closer to 14 weeks. This episode was turned out in 4. So it's something of a miracle.
Mm.
And then he goes ahead and wins a Hugo as well. So, you know, an amazing episode of Star Trek.
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, I must admit that since The Cage came out on sell-through video end of the 80s, I don't think I've seen this episode.
Right.
And I watched the hell out of it during the 80s.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it was so good.
Yeah.
And then, as soon as The Cage comes out, I'm just watching The Cage.
Yeah.
Rather than
The Menagerie.
The Menagerie.
Yeah, I've done that. I've made that same mistake.
Yeah.
And I think it is a mistake.
And it is a mistake because when you watch it, you think, this is just not just an amazing episode. This is an amazing piece of television.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure Derek might correct me here, but it's unique. The way that it's produced, and we've seen lots of flashback episodes before where they've taken stuff from episodes or even clip shows, but this is different. This is where it's an integral part. Them watching the events is actually a part of what of the actual narrative. This is the fact that they're actually sitting down and watching telly.
Yeah.
This whole courtroom drama thing, while also film narrative discussion is just, I think, unique, and I don't know if it exists anywhere else.
So, do you think that this is a happy accident then? Because you see, obviously, they've got this.
Yeah.
They've got
It is a completely happy accident.
It's necessity.
Yeah,
that's coming up.
This was a plot driven by commercial necessity.
Yeah,
it is art that comes directly from commerce. And in that respect, it is really rare because most would probably hold that it's very difficult under those circumstances to create genuine art. But this has been done. I mean, you know, they don't give Hugo Awards out willy-nilly.
And it was the first Hugo Award they won.
I think so, yeah. I don't know whether or not City on the Edge of Forever won a Hugo.
That one...
But of course, that was the end of the first season, so no. So yes, of course it was. It's halfway point in the season, so...
With the Hugo Awards, I actually read that it was Harlan Ellison who was the compere and actually gave the award for this episode.
Probably was. Almost.
Oh, really?
He was the compare for pretty much every year.
Okay, well, that's really interesting. But, I mean, this, we can't be surprised by this. It's a close community, so, yeah, I mean, I know that they were at odds, but, I mean, like, you know... They would always be meeting up in these kind of functions and that. So, well, just a quick recap then. So what happens is, so they've gone, we're running out of time. We need to get a show together. Why don't we just use the cage? Because it's this lavish, well-produced episode of Star Trek that's just sitting there out of time. And hadn't been seen. So let's just use it. So Roddenberry said, okay, we'll do that. He turned it into a two-part episode. And then he wrote this really very tightly put together envelope around it, and which starts with Spock being reintroduced to Christopher Pike, who has had this horrific accident and contrives a way of stealing the Enterprise, absconding with the Enterprise and Pike, so that he can take them to Talos IV, and so that he can, through their magic, through their masters of illusion, through their illusory powers, restore him to the illusion of health, and you can live happily ever after. And it's a great sentiment. And these are classic Star Trek tropes, aren't they? This is one of the big things about Star Trek is the interpersonality of the characters. It's their loyalty and it's sacrifice. And these are the big key elements always about what is authentic Star Trek. And one of those reasons is because, frankly, the Menagerie. Lays down that in a way that people, that even Spock, as cold and unemotional as he is willing to sacrifice everything for the happiness and well-being of a friend, even if it means sacrificing the friendship of his commanding officer.
It's a great Spock episode.
Yeah, it's another great Spock episode, isn't it? Yeah.
You know, Leonard Nimoy's acting chops on this are pretty good. Yeah. The way he holds.
The scene at the end of part one, you know, there's a real sincerity about Spock who's, you know, asking Jim, look, don't stop me. Don't make him stop me. I need to do this. You know, it's your career and it's my life.
Yeah.
You know, and this point where they have reached this point of no return. So, look, Spock is reconciled to the fact that he's likely to be put to death. And he's prepared to be reconciled for the fact that he's going to cost the career of his best friend as well. But the die is now cast, and if they fail, then it will all be, all that sacrifice is for absolutely nothing. And I really enjoyed that real moment of real, that's you, Shatner portrays the sense of betrayal, I think, extremely well. You know, that, you know, almost like this guy, he likes this guy more than he likes me. Would he do the same for me? And it's a really good cornerstone in their friendship.
Certainly. Yeah. It is. Kirk doesn't get to do a lot in this other than react and wonder what's going on. So it's not a strong Kirk episode, even though there is a lot of very intense things that are happening.
Yeah.
And of course, with the introduction of a new character there as well, with the Commodore Mendes.
Yeah.
Adding another layer of intrigue there. And interplay.
Yeah.
And you've got also the mute Pike.
Yes.
As well.
Yeah.
As an always present feature in the corner, but without being able to input anything other than no or yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Obviously, Captain Pike. The memo from is it NBC? I forget the network. But the memo from the network to Gene was saying, you know, can you make certain that you don't make Captain Pike too horrific, you know, because, you know, we don't want to upset too many people. I think that they also probably quite iconic, actually, that whole business with him in that wheelchair and with the two
like
tones.
Yeah.
There's echoes of Davros. Davros has echoes of of Pike with this. It is a bit of a trope, the sort of, you know, the sort of gnarled figure in the wheelchair. But I mean, obviously Davros is like totally evil, whereas Pike is just such a tragic figure.
Yeah.
When we see Obviously, it's not the same actor. They don't. They couldn't possibly have afforded Jeffrey Hunter.
Yeah, what was Jeffrey Hunter doing at the time?
He was Jesus.
Jeffrey Hunter was not doing Star Trek. Yeah. He did not want to do Star Trek, and didn't. And I don't even think he was asked back because I think they felt the answer would be no. And also, Jeff Hunter was at the time not A-list, but he was a working actor in film and would have been expensive.
Jesus. He was Jesus.
He played Jesus in Indian.
Well, there you go.
We've talked about him a little bit, Jeff Hunter, in our episode on The Cage, but it is worth revisiting. But his performance also has extra resonance because we're seeing Captain Pike as this, you know, dynamic figure. And then in contrast, we've then got this really tragic situation where this great guy has been reduced to such circumstances.
What I like about it, though, is that the sequences with the view screen with watching something that happened 13 years before, is it really does look like it was 13 years before.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what's...
So clever.
How long between it? Like a year or so?
So it would have been at the most 2 years. From a design point of view, stage, yeah. But you're right. I mean, it's Roddenberry. We occasionally have a little bit of fun with Gene Roddenberry because we maybe feel that perhaps, you know, he celebrated more than maybe he deserves. Mm-hmm. But I mean, he really pulled out an absolute gem with this one. This is just top drawer, and it all worked. And he must have occurred to me, just thought, this is great. Just looking at the cage again and thinking, these guys look. This looks like it could be a Bridge of the Enterprise from 10, 13 years earlier. And it'll work really well. And it's just, you know.
And the characterization, the way that Nimoy has refined himself as Spock.
Yeah.
In those first dozen or so episodes.
Yeah.
Now he's moved on, and now he looks, there could easily be 10 years have passed in the way that he looks and acts.
Yeah, absolutely. You can put it down to the passage of time.
Yeah.
If he decided to say, well, I will set it maybe only a couple of years ago or something like that, then it would have grated. But he said, no, it needs to be 13 years because we need to explain the character deficit or imply the character, the inconsistency. But it just, like, aesthetically just...
Yeah, even that shot, where he picks up the communicator, it's almost as if you saw that in a modern program now, it would be as if they're drawing our attention to this older tech.
Yeah,
this rather than the sleek communicators that they have now. That big chunky one, because they've gone so far in the past, and it is just such a happy accident.
Yeah,
I've said before on this podcast that where Star Trek, especially in season 3, whereby the Star Trek always does better when it's going with the constraints that it has rather than fighting it.
Yeah,
and this is the perfect example. In the first season, but with the constraints obviously imposed upon it, and then working with those constraints.
Yeah,
it just works wonderfully.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's plenty of there's a few examples of it where it doesn't work, but I mean, like, we can look at Spectre of the Gun in the third season when they constructed this amazing set, a Western backdrop, and looking the way it was because they didn't have the money to build a full set.
Yeah,
and it worked 10 times better. And of course, we all know and love Wrath of Khan, which was made with just basically where they were literally going through the dumpsters of other studio lots to steal bits of scenery, you know, and these are, you know, memorable and great sort of like Star Trek stories. So, but yes.
Isn't it a case of just getting rid of the fluff? Because I was just thinking that the thing about the flashback sequences, we call them flashback sequences, is actually you see the best bits from the cage.
Yeah.
You don't see all the worrying bits, you know, sort of like all the bits that are a bit
Stuff from the cage which is a bit clunky, we're spared that.
Yeah, we're spared that. We got those really good sequences all the way through, which is nice. And then you've got the framing sequence, which is great, where you've got the great actors who are in that, and the conflict.
Yeah,
you know, and you've got Commodore Mendors. I mean, the thing is seeing that also a slightly different uniform because you've got the different crests there as well, and you know that. So
it's so funny.
It opens up the
the crest thing was all an accident. Because, like, they were supposed to all have the Delta, But it was a design, it was miscommunication for the design for Charlie X, it was, where they went, oh, you know, or was it court-martial? Anyway, for one of them, and they went, and they thought, oh, they want a different logo. I said, no, we want the same logo. Well, at which point the design had been done, right. And that's it. And that's why no one has any problem with them retconning the fact that Starfleet now, back in that time, all has the Delta, because that's how it's supposed to be. But interesting canonical diversion there. Malachi Throne, who you referred to in our last episode.
Yeah, as the voice of
as the voice of the Guardian. Guardian
Forever.
Yeah.
Actually, I had dug up something else about him.
Yeah.
He originally was cast as Boyce.
Oh, was he really?
Yeah. But he turned it down because he actually wanted to be Spock.
So he went for, yeah, I can totally see him as Spock.
You know,
he's definitely got I think that would have worked really, really nicely, wouldn't it? If it had been.
But he would have been a brilliant voice as well.
Yeah, I mean, he's brilliant in this.
I thought I'd stumbled upon a great callback with Mendez, but I was disappointed.
Oh, go on. Let's all share your disappointment.
I think it's the beginning of the Mantrap.
Yeah.
When they're going off to a starbase. And Kirk says something, and there's a special delivery they've got to deliver there for the Starbase commander. And Kirk says, Jose will have to wait for his chilies.
Yes.
Or something.
Could yes. be, yeah.
Yes.
That's a
and
good
I one. Thought, is this the Starbase Jose? Is yeah. that, and no. Different surname.
Nearly there.
And I thought,
awesome.
That would have been the king of callbacks, wouldn't it?
But I was going to go back with Malachi. He was also, he originally did the voices of the keepers in yes. the cage.
Yes.
So
yeah, of course. Change. Yeah, I've forgotten about that. Yeah, no, good. Well, good. Yeah, thanks very much.
Bloody
yeah.
hell, he was in a lot. Did a lot of stuff in Star Trek.
He's actually. The kind of guy you've seen him doing quite a lot of stuff. I've seen him about in old TV shows from the 1960s and 1970s.
He's a good actor.
Mm. But it's great to have number one in there as well, though. Isn't
oh,
it?
Yeah.
This is the fact that it actually puts her there in there rather than actually being completely written out as Star Trek, because she would have been.
Yeah, such an impact, obviously, in the fan fiction because everyone wanted to know who's this.
Well, yeah, a female in authority. Yeah, I mean that would have been a really interesting Star Trek if it had been picked up after the cage. But
also, I mean, it's going to be great that she's obviously going to be in the new series of Discovery, but of course, you know, it's going to be a modern version, so it'd be. Interesting how much of the old version still exists in it.
Yeah, I wonder how much she features in the show. Hopefully she's in it quite a bit, but I don't, we don't know, do we? We just don't know. I mean, we've talked about the obviously the importance of the episode, of the fact that they managed to do this and it was that good. But it also, I would suggest to you that it's hit that halfway point in the season. If they had not pulled this episode out and actually had been able to had missed a deadline and not gotten out, I reckon that probably would have cooked that show.
Yeah,
would a show would have been cancelled if they can't produce it and get it out to time. Then they would have just said, "Look, we're not going." They may even have cancelled it mid-series. It's not out of the way, because they did and they do that. Networks do cancel shows mid-series, and they may well have done that. So there's an important the significance of the menagerie is not just in terms of the narrative and the legacy that it creates creatively, but also the fact that we probably wouldn't have had a Star Trek franchise if they hadn't have been able to have done this.
Well, you can imagine that whole 2 week extra giving the production crew would have been so vital, and probably the reason why the episodes that follow it are so good.
Yeah. It almost gave them a mid-season break, didn't it?
Yeah, and it gives it that extra bit. That's how you imagine it would work, because you know you look at those episodes that are coming up soon afterwards, and you think, my God, there's some real gold there, isn't it?
It is worth just illustrating to listeners that they were. I mean, it's a really busy job anyway doing this at the best of times, but those optical guys, the special effects guys, they were working flat out, and were just so far behind. It could have been disastrous, and although this would have given them, it wouldn't have given them a break, but it would have given them time to catch up.
Yeah.
Well, they still would have been like pulling all-nighters and get to get the show out and ready.
I mean, this episode does still have quite a bit of optical effects in it.
It does, yeah.
Yeah, because you've got the star base itself.
Yes, but you've got a lot of reused optics. Yeah. There's a couple of Albert Whitlock matte paintings that have been commissioned for other shows that they've dropped in, which is quite clever. I think the one from Court Martial, I think, for the backdrop for Mendez's office, maybe. And I think also when they land, the one that was from Taste of Armageddon, if memory serves. So I suggest that these are probably already matte paintings that are already, you know.
And you got that lovely one actually in the Cage episode.
I know, yeah, we always love to talk about the Rigel one. Yeah. I did a before and after on of all of those. I found this really good website where they've got all the matte paintings of, and then the remastered ones,
right,
and with comments as well from the people who took the decision to do the remaster and what they did. And they hardly touched Whitlock's Rigel 7 castle. They did point out, which of course is quite right, is that, you know, these paintings just cannot be upscaled in an HD format. Yes, you know, true. They just cannot be. So they do need to be enhanced and kind of replaced. So, you know, that gives you an indication as to.
Yeah, and I think it's fine as long as you are drawing your influence from the original.
Yeah.
And you are improving it for a new platform.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, because we have in the past, we've said that actually there are very few surviving map paintings in the remastered here. But that I'm more comfortable with that now, having upon looking at it again, that's not actually the case.
Yeah.
But they have been, you know, as you say, some are like the Devil in the Dark one is more, you know, has been changed quite a lot. Mm. The Janus 4 one. Mm. But some of the other ones, like the Rigel 7 one, has been really, you know, I could do a whole series on those.
I just want to ask actually about the paintings, the originals. Are they any?
I have no idea where they are.
Did they end up in someone's collection? That's a great question. Or a museum?
Yeah, no. I'm terrified that they've probably just been junked.
Yeah. It's,
because they've just.
Yeah.
It's commerce, mate. Capitalism doesn't recognise art.
The thing is that.
It's an asset as far as they're concerned.
Going back to the way they reused things, it's a bit like the BBC. I mean, you junk stuff, like all those episodes of Doctor Who. But. You know, with this, they had to cut up the old pilot to actually make the the sequence, the flashback sequences. But that was, I think, that was the reason why when we first came to the Cage when it was released on VHS, we had the black and white sequences and the colour sequences that were existing from this episode that they sort of put together. So they were actually physically cut the thing, and this is what ended up, and this is what they could use.
Yeah.
It was only later on that they actually found all the cutoffs later on, and then they put them back together for the remastered stuff. Except that they found another version which had the slightly different soundtrack on it. So it's all
interesting.
So there is contentions about whether these were completely retouched or because they had two different colour versions. They had one that had no soundtrack on it at all, and then there was one that had the combined soundtrack with the colour-eyed version, and then obviously you had Gene Roddenberry's black and white version that he had in his own collection, which they used for the VHS.
Because that one has got different voices for the keepers, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it does. Well, that
first sell-through one had that, didn't it?
Yeah, it's got that change. Yeah. It's really like,
quite jarring, isn't it?
Yeah. But I mean, it was great.
I know. It does add something to it almost.
Definitely.
It's but it does have this sort of like weird sort of dream thing about that you sort of come in and out of consciousness.
But also being black and white, it does completely make it feel even older than it really is.
Yeah, it really, you know. it works. So, I mean, it might have been interesting if they'd actually made a creative decision to not colourise it and say, look, we're actually doing this in black and white.
If they'd released that black and white version, I would
have thought they would have put it onto a DVD extra.
And actually, or rather have it through the, in story, have it on the view screen as black and white rather than as colour to see whether, and I imagine that's the whole, again, one of the reasons why Star Trek was commissioned was to sell colour telly, so I suppose that probably wasn't something that they would want to do, but I'm surprised it doesn't,
I mean, it probably does somewhere now, but exist in a marketable format that they
sure if there's interest in doing it. Yeah, I'm sure there will be.
All the way through.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah, maybe so. I'm sure. I mean, from a historic, if you're a Star Trek historian, you'd probably want to have that in your collection, wouldn't you?
But that was the reason why they changed the voices for the Menagerie, because obviously you've already got the same actor who's in the same episode.
Yes, I suppose.
So you wouldn't want the same voice.
Yeah. You don't want to it's so not the animated series just yet, is it?
Yeah.
Let's just explore the story legacy of the episode as well. I mean, Pike is a massive figure in history, and we are going to be seeing Pike in the new series of Star Trek Discovery, which I think we're all probably actually looking forward to. I mean, it's quite cool because we have Pike in the J.J. Abrams movies as well. Interestingly, in the first two, I can't say I'm a big fan of what they did with Pike in that, but I guess it does. I'm a big fan of I can't remember the name of the actor. I'm a big fan of the character in the movies. Great character.
Yeah.
Big fan of the fact that he was more of a kind of father figure to Kirk in that timeline. I'm all on board with that. Didn't like the way it ended for him, but I suppose it is in line with the fact that Pike ultimately meets a tragic demise, doesn't he? Or at least he doesn't.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, you know, something awful is going to happen to her. And it's pointing to that. So in whatever timeline Pike exists in, it seems to him that he's going to be afflicted by great tragedy.
Yeah, the fates have it in for him, don't they?
Yes, yeah, they do.
And also, it's the old lesson of mortality for Kirk as well, because the thing is, this is his predecessor on the Enterprise.
Yeah.
And he has met Pike at least once.
Yeah.
But there's also that relationship to Pike and Spock as well. So there's a bit more depth there, isn't there?
Yeah.
Sort of like you feel, okay, this is the previous captain of the Enterprise. He's basically bought it. This can happen to Kirk. There's also the relationship and so on. It's multifaceted.
These are themes that were explored in the Doomsday Machine, of course, where Kirk is confronted with Decker and thinks, that could be me.
Yeah.
And could have been me and may well be me in the future.
And the theme returns again, obviously, in the motion picture.
Yeah, there's a I mean, Starship Captain's an incredibly dangerous job, you would think. I mean, I think that you'll be interested to see how Anson Mount plays Pike, because apparently he's a big fan. And you would imagine, therefore, probably maybe lobbied for the gig if he heard about it. But I mean, he looks, again, we're only going by the trailers, but he looks decent.
Mm.
Are you guys comfortable with this sort of like idea of, we must be comfortable now of having these characters being replayed by different actors now? I mean, the Kelvin movie, the JJ movies have kind of broken that seal, so to speak, haven't they? And you know, this is no big deal now, are we? Is it?
No, I'm fine. I'm fine with it. I would have much rather, when you're looking at the latest Disney Star Wars films, and you see, oh, they bring back Moff Tarkin, or they've got CGI Princess Leia in there, and you think, well, no, give it to another actor.
Yeah,
let someone else bring it out.
Yeah,
let someone else give this to a new generation.
Imagine the reaction from some sections of Star Wars fandom if they did that.
Yeah,
they did it with Solo. You're right. Yeah. Obviously, that's a younger Solo. They probably felt that they could that was justified creatively.
But I think they're going to use that now as just to say, right, okay, well, this is what we do now.
I think that it's fine, and I think that it was a perfect. I think the way that it ended up happening through the Paramount movies is actually worked well, because they're going, look, here's an alternative timeline, and this will allow you, the audience, to be comfortable with other actors playing famous characters.
Because we don't want to see Shatner back in
a... No, we really don't.
No.
But I love the way...
I love Boss Shatner, but we don't want to see him back. You know.
I love the way that Marvel have done it with the X-Men.
Yeah.
For instance. Yes. Yeah. I mean, that works for me. That works brilliantly. Yeah. I mean, they messed the timelines are going all over the place in that. And but hey, who cares? They make good films.
And you're wearing a Hulk t-shirt. And of course, the Hulk has been played by three different actors.
Yeah.
So, and they don't get more iconic than the Hulk, do they?
Yeah.
So, I mean, we should all be comfortable with this. And James Frayn, who plays Sarek in Epic Discovery, is a brilliant Sarek.
Yeah.
And it really adds to it, and I think that they've been really on point when they did that, and I've got absolute faith that the new Mud is brilliant. I've got absolute faith that that Spock and Pike and indeed Number One are all going to be faithful. It's a testimony to the characters and the strength and depth of the characters as well. But it's also, as you say, Graham, an opportunity to reinvigorate these characters to a whole new generation of fans.
Well, it used to be a case of there wasn't a problem with actually recasting people. It's just that I think Star Trek was its own worst enemy.
To an extent, Star Trek is guilty of actually saying, oh, no, you can't change that. That's, he's iconic. Because, we probably can.
Yeah.
And we will if we have to. I mean, they've said that before. I mean, I think at one point when they were arguing over money for a movie, they said, look, if you don't do it, Governor, we'll hire a new actor and do it that way. It's up to you, So there are limits, it would have been interesting to see what would have happened.
Well, mortality is the biggest limit.
Mortality being the biggest. But also, the reason why Star Trek IV is still in development hell is because Chris Pine has ascended and his value has gone up. And there is a gap. There's a funding gap between what Paramount think the role of Captain Kirk is worth and what Chris Pine thinks the role of Captain Kirk is worth.
Yeah.
Is worth. And
the,
so they
the
may
role
say,
of Chris Pine
they might well go, you know what?
Yeah.
We can replace you.
Well, this is a problem when you've got a big ensemble cast, isn't it? Because unless you've got the budget like the Avengers has.
Yes.
And you're willing to drive a truckload of money up to Robert Downey Jr.'s house.
Yes.
Every year, every time you wanted to put on the tin
that
suit.
That stupid bloody suit, yeah.
And I'm sure he's very happy with
it. I don't imagine he has the slightest issue with it.
When he hears that band with the reversing alarm going out there.
Oh, it's the Marvel truck.
It's the Marvel truck with all that cash.
Is it Tuesday? Shit, quick, the Marvel truck's here. Get the bags out.
Which I suppose that's what success is about. And so...
Yeah. I mean, my personal thinking for Star Trek IV is that they should just turn it into a Spock movie and make Zachary Quinto the guy and just maybe just get Chris Pine in for a few days to do some cameo work and then just make it a Spock episode. Mm-hmm. I reckon it will probably be as successful, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Because Spock is in many ways the lead character. I mean, I will close things up, but I'll just emphasise actually that point because in the memo... in that same memo that I referred to from the network to Gene Roddenberry, it was, we're glad that you're making Spock a prominent figure in his character. The studio sort of read the draft, they said it's a great script. Congratulations, this is going to be brilliant. And thank you very much for making Spock a more prominent character in this, because it's very clear that he is becoming one of the most popular characters in the show. And this is, we're talking mid-season TOS while they're coming out, so we're only probably seen about half a dozen episodes, but the audience reaction already is that, and in fact this is all done by necessity, it's all done by happenstance. It's like, we need this to be a Spock heavy episode because Spock's also in this, we need to tie it together, and it all just worked perfectly. It is such a serendipitous episode of Star Trek, The Menagerie Parts 1 and 2, and we would literally, I don't think we'd be talking about Star Trek if it wasn't for it.
No, it laid down the foundations for future Star Trek.
Yeah.
It just opened it up.
And we should all pay homage to it whenever
we can. It became more
than
an anthology series after
that. Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay. Now, have I omitted anything about this episode that we should be discussing?
Why does Mendes disappear at the end?
I don't know that.
Oh, that's
obviously it's part of the illusion, but I thought, why did they didn't need to do that. They didn't. You're right. They didn't need to do that.
It's weird. It's like the bit. It's like when Leonard Nimoy's in that Simpsons episode, wasn't it?
Didn't I?
Why does he disappear?
The thing is, he's on the with Uhura straight away, saying that that Spock is being.
Yeah, he authorized. Said,
yeah,
it's cool.
He's
cool. Don't worry, everything's cool.
Everything's cool. But
so he could have done that from where he was sat. He could have totally done that. He could have gone.
Yeah, but he wasn't.
You know what?
But he wasn't there. He was.
The
issue is that with the Faolians, I can't even say their name now.
Talosians.
Is that. Supposedly, this area has been quarantined because there's a race of really powerful telepaths there who could, And so the idea, you quarantine in their vicinity, so no one goes near there, they leave them alone. But they're so powerful that Starbase 11
has been affected by everything that was happening on there with the Phantom Menders. So you think
Phantom Menders. Thank you. There's your episode title. Yeah. Thank you, Delboy. The Phantom Menders. Oh, my days.
I think we need to stop right now.
Okay. We need to stop
Anyway,
we also haven't talked about the ethics of having a death penalty, but
yeah, there is another little faux pas in there. Is that the sheet with the order? I forgot what it is. General order.
General 7, isn't it?
Yeah. Is actually signed by. Was it Captain Christopher Pike and half Vulcan science officer Spock? And they actually say half Vulcan science officer. I know, it's really weird, but you can actually see it if you actually freeze.
A bit racist, really, to be perfectly honest.
A bit racist. To go with all the sexism.
Well, you had that. Most of the sexism was cut out, except for obviously the bit with Spock going, "The women!"
The best line in all of Star Trek.
The women!
The women! I want that as a message tone now.
Oh dear. Okay, well, look, now we really are going to wrap this up now. This is our second attempt to end this podcast. So we are. Let's, chaps, what say we go down the pub, have a beer, and then go and watch some football and just otherwise indulge in non-toxic masculinity. How about that? All right. Cheers. So from me, Terry DeFan, and from Derek Mantle, and from Graham Sibley, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.
Captain Pike, he has an illusion, and you have reality. May you find your way as pleasant.